downstairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you. Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you. And I wonder what it is I should do. It's so hard to keep the smile from my face. Losing control, yeah.
Hello once again to each and all, and welcome to the newsletter from GaiaSpora.org, offering Gnostic intel and Sophianic insight on events and issues of today. This is issue number 8, presented by your friendly homegrown Telestis, John Lash. The title is Islam, Line in the Sand. Now I'm recording on the 10th of January in the morning. It's a Saturday morning. And by now, the entire world knows that 3 days ago, on Wednesday, the 7th of January, when I happened to be down on the coast in Marbella to run some errands, that there occurred a terrorist event in Paris, France. And in this event, two Muslim terrorists, two Islamic fundamentalists, if you want to call them that, armed with Kalashnikovs, executed 10 French cartoonists. These people were part of the team running the French magazine Charlie Hebdo, which is a magazine of satirical, political, cultural commentary. And these 10 people, plus two policemen who got caught up in the fray, died on that day. But specifically, I want to bring your attention to a fact that the entire world knows, although some would deny that it is a fact. So I want to tell you, I consider this to be a fact. I'm speaking of evidence and causality. If you want to understand facts, you have to have evidence on the one hand, and you have to have causality on the other hand. Now, the evidence is concrete. The bullets shot from the automatic rifles that could be retrieved from the bodies of these people, that's evidence. It's always something concrete. And causality is a process of rational thinking that connects things into a logical and probable chain of events. So, my statement that I'm making right now, which many people would dispute, is this. The gunman executed the 10 French cartoonists as an act of retribution dictated in Islam against anyone who portrays the Prophet Muhammad, or at the same time, and or insults Islam or insults the Prophet. That's it. It is a fact based on the textual evidence of the foundation documents of Islam that adherents to that faith are told that death is the punishment or retribution, if you will, to be meted out to those who portray their prophet, who portray the physical image of Muhammad, and equally so, it is the required action to be taken against those who offend and insult Islam. And this is what happened in Paris, resulting in the death of these 10 people who were cartoonists. They died for cartoons, principally. Although some people would debate that statement, along with the two policemen who got caught up in the fray, as I said. Now, before I launch into the Gnostic commentary on this event, I want to make explicit some of the terms that are going to float in and out of my monologue. These terms are also going to float in and out of your minds, and they are currently floating in and out of the minds of millions of people around the world, millions upon millions of people, wherever they may live on the planet, who are discussing and considering this event. One of the words is satire. Charlie Hebdo was a satiric magazine. The tradition of satire belongs mainly and centrally to the intellectual culture of the white European West. And satire is a literary genre that is well known since the Renaissance in European culture. There are famous American satirists, such as Mark Twain, who wrote Letters to the Earth, which was a series of letters supposedly written by Satan addressed to people on Earth. That's satire. Jonathan Swift, who is an Irishman, wrote A Modest Proposal, in which he proposed that the eating of newborn infants could be a solution to birth control or lack of birth control, overpopulation. That was a satire. I could go on and name a great number of satires. You may have heard me mention the Russian satirist Evgeny Zamyatin, who played a unique role in the Stalinist period. So satire is an important factor in the so-called freedom of expression of what I am going to call the white Western humanist society. White Western humanist society, and by Western I mean Euro-American. Okay? Now, it's certainly true that satire exists and has played a significant role in other countries of the world. I'm not talking now about South America or Latin America or satire in Japan or satire in African literature. A lot of the folklore, which was, of course, and still is, spoken folklore of Africa, concerns the figure of the trickster. And a great deal of the tales concerning the trickster in African folklore are satirical. But I'm not addressing all those areas. I'm just addressing the part of the planet that is in closest proximity to these events. Okay? Now, another word to clarify is the word iconoclasm. Iconoclasm means the breaking or throwing down or shattering of icons. An icon, by this definition, is a graphic depiction of something, namely a graphic depiction of a living animal or a person is an icon in this definition. And iconoclasm refers to the position taken by someone who destroys such images or objects to their existing, someone who would use violent force to destroy such images, for instance, a depiction of the face and figure of the Prophet Muhammad, and who would violently attack or murder anyone who presented such a depiction, such an icon. So, iconoclasm is central to Islam. Islam is an iconoclastic religion, and so is Judaism. That is to say that in those religions, there exist teachings in the form of imperatives. It's not a teaching like I would teach you how to watch birds, or I would teach you how to change a tire of a car. So it's incorrect to call them teachings. Within those religions, there are imperatives, there are demands made upon the inherent adherents of the religion. And one of the demands of Islam is that no one shall depict the face of the Prophet Muhammad. And certainly, by extension, no one is allowed, the religion forbids, getting out of the passive voice, the religion forbids anyone to insult the Prophet Muhammad in any way. Well, since satire is a genre that consists of ridiculing and insulting, then certainly a satirical portrayal of the Prophet Muhammad would be considered in that religion, so-called religion of Islam, to be sufficient cause to murder those who committed this portrayal. This is a fact. This is a fact about Islam. I want to draw a very clear distinction here, however, regarding the way the imperative is stated. Sorry, I have to go to passive voice from time to time, but I'm attempting to avoid it as much as possible in this particular talk. There is the religion of Islam, so-called religion. There is the ideology of Islam. And within it, you find the imperative that says no one shall depict visually or graphically the Prophet Muhammad. It is forbidden to do so. When you hear those words, when you hear that statement, which is directly and literally taken from the doctrines of Islam, the written doctrines of Islam, and the preachings of many ayatollahs and imams and clerics, you need to ask this question: forbidden to whom? Now, this is a really important issue regarding Islam. And you can see the nature of Islam clearly based on that question: forbidden to whom? Now, if you are born into Islam and you are a Muslim who adheres to the principles of that religion, the tenets, whatever you want to call them, then you certainly, then the faith certainly requires of you that you do not make such a portrayal. So it forbids you, a Muslim, to do that. But how can it forbid people who are not Muslims to do that as well? You'd have to stop and ask yourself, for instance, suppose I belong to a religious cult, and one of the imperatives of my cult is that it forbids us to eat hot dogs. Okay, so there's so many members in the cult, there can be 5, there can be 5 million. And if we are loyal to the imperatives of the cult, we don't eat hot dogs. But what if we take the position that nobody on the planet can eat hot dogs? So here I am in my cult. I'm not eating hot dogs. And then I observe the behavior of those many millions of people who do not belong to my cult, and I see that they are freely and openly eating hot dogs. Well, there are 2 possibilities here. One is that I am indifferent to non-cult members eating hot dogs. It's none of my business. They're not part of the organization. They haven't committed themselves to it. So they can do whatever they want, and I leave them alone. The other position is the position taken in Islam, which is, Islam forbids its own adherents, to portray Muhammad, and additionally, it forbids all non-Muslims as well, kafirs, as they are called. K-A-F-I-R. A kafir is an infidel. It's the name for a non-Muslim. So the attitude of Islam is that it dictates a rule, an imperative, to those who are outside the faith, if you will. Those who are not part of the Islamic belief system. It extends to kafirs. And this is a point that Bill Warner often makes in his discussion of Islam. So I'll return to that a bit later. Another point I want to make in setting up this talk is about threats. If you observe the behavior of Muslims in the world today, is immediately obvious that threats come from the Muslim world toward the non-Muslim world. Now, you don't necessarily find this with other so-called great world religions. And since I'm not aware that Hinduism or Confucianism or Taoism or even Christianity is characterized by a constant stream of threats toward everyone who does not partake of those religions. Open threats with the assertion that the threats will be implemented by violence, and in some cases, the aim of acting out the threat will be murder. So the world saw that threat coming from the Islamic world acted out in Paris. The staff of Charlie Hebdo were living under that threat, just as the Danish cartoonist was living under that threat, and other people who have defied Islam and done things that the adherents of Islam find offensive live under threat, and in some cases the threat gets to be implemented. Now, the symbol of this threat is the sword. The sword figures very largely in the rhetoric of Islam. Now, the Muslim terrorists in Paris used automatic weapons. They did not use swords, but they may as well have used swords. The actions they performed were similar to the actions of beheading that Muhammad performed on hundreds and hundreds of people, as described vividly in his biography. The biography of Muhammad describes him beheading hundreds of people. What is the difference between that and executing them with Kalashnikovs? It's merely a technical difference. And so the sword of Islam is a symbol of the power of Islam to carry out the threats it makes toward the kafir. But I would point out something about the sword of Islam. When you see it depicted with Arabic writing, when you read about it in the Quran, when it's used as a metaphor for the application of force in jihad, the application of force to subjugate the non-Muslim kafir population to Islam, the sword carries that significance. I would have you consider the sword as an object that you have in your mind, that you've seen, that you've pictured before. What do you think of when you picture a sword? Well, I think of two things immediately. First, I think of chivalry and the Arthurian knights. And those characters, those heroic figures from European history and legend, carried swords, and they fought with swords. Likewise, I think about samurai in Japan, obviously. There could be others, but these are two primary examples and very well-known examples of the sword as an image, as an archetypal image, if you will, but also as an actual weapon of harm and death. And I ask you to consider this. Can you think of any instances of the use of the sword in the Western chivalric tradition or among the samurai of Japan in which it is used to slaughter defenseless people, unarmed, defenseless people? To put the question another way, I can ask you if you can recall any image you have seen of an Arab or Muslim brandishing a sword in which you saw that individual in a sword fight with another swordsman. No, you never see the Islam sword used in a sword fight, do you? It's only used to behead people who are on their knees with their hands tied behind them, who can't run, who can't defend themselves, who don't have their own sword to fight back with. And so, I make that point because I want to focus your minds on an essential observation about Islam, that Islam is at war with the non-Islamic world, but it's not really a war with that would occur, for instance, with two armies clashing. In the imagination of Islam, this war is conducted with a sword, hacking up, beheading, and killing people who do not have swords, people who cannot fight back, and that is the dream of Islam to achieve the meaning of the word Islam, which is submission or subjugation. Submission or subjugation of whom to what? Submission or subjugation of the kafirs, the non-Islamic people of the world, to those who are born into Islam and who are faithful to the tenets and imperatives of that system. Now, I don't know if any of you have been investigating Islam to get an idea of what it actually is. I can tell you one thing. It does require some investigation because what you hear about it on the mainstream media is not very misleading, is very misleading and not fairly represented. And also, debates over Islam very rarely get to the essence of what it is. So I have found over the past 6 months that my view of Islam has been informed by following Dr. Bill Warner. His site is politicalislam.org. And so I've linked here to a number of his talks. He explains the destruction of Western civilization by Islam. He explains in talk two, A Taste of Islam, what Islam is actually composed of, textually speaking. The third reference is a good summary of the confusion about how Islam is viewed, and it proposes how to win the war against the political ideology of Islam. Bill Warner, by the way, repeatedly states and shows that Islam is not a religion. It is a political ideology of total conquest of the non-Islamic world and non-Islamic peoples. And I would add a word that, as far as I know, he doesn't use, which is theocracy. I would say, to put it in a soundbite, that Islam, which literally means submission or subjugation, is a political ideology of absolute theocratic tyranny, period. And it is only disguised as a religion. The disguise is convincing to many people, especially unknowing Muslims who do not have the intelligence to look, or the motivation to look honestly and nakedly at the nature of their belief system. I think it would also be, well, it is my observation, but I contend that this observation can be supported by fact, that the vast, vast majority of Muslims in the world, what is it, 1.4 or 1.6 billion, one in every four or five people is a Muslim, the vast majority of them exhibit a level of intelligence that is extremely marginal. One of the problems with Islam is that the many dupes who are in that belief system do not have the intelligence to see the game that they are in. They don't have the critical intelligence to see the game. And this is extremely unfortunate for them, and it is one of the things that makes Islam extremely dangerous as well. I would say that the absence of self-critical faculties and critical evaluation in the Muslim mentality is extremely alarming. And likewise, going along with that, I believe that an investigation of that culture will reveal also an absence of the capacity, or an extremely impaired capacity, to discover proof and to engage in the process of causal reasoning that leads from proof to conclusions about events. Islam declares itself to be the final revelation of God, and the first line of the Quran, you might like to know, is variously translated, of course, but fairly can be translated as, "This book shall not be questioned," or, "This is the book, there is no doubt in it." The sense of this first line of the second chapter, which is the first chapter, is simply pray in praise of Allah and Muhammad. The sense of this line indicates that it is the revealed word of God, and that there is no single line or word that can be questioned by the human mind. So immediately you encounter in Islam the total censorship of critical thinking among its adherents. Now, what I'd like to do in the next 15 minutes of this newsletter is to cover some of the key points that you need to know in order to understand Islam. And I want to emphasize that it is, in my view, absolutely imperative that anyone on this planet who considers himself or herself to be interested in humanity, in what humanity is, in the origin and purpose of human life, in the nature of the experiment on this planet, and who takes an interest in the future of human society, I want to stress that it is absolutely imperative that you educate yourself in the fundamentals of Islam. So I've listed some of the keywords that you have to understand in the quest to penetrate Islam. I myself do not always pronounce these words consistently or correctly, so I'll try to pronounce them correctly. I change the accent because I'm not familiar with these words. I don't particularly like them, and so I misaccent them. So I'll try to accent them correctly. Quran, Kafir, Islam, as Bill Warner pronounces it, Islam, Taqiyya, Hadith, or the Hadith, see, I don't know. The biography of Muhammad, there's a name for that, but I don't know what it is. Sharia, Allah, Gabriel, same as the Archangel Gabriel in Christianity. Mecca and Medina, the two key places, which are in Saudi Arabia, although it turns out on grounds of historical evidence that the Quran and the events concerning its origin in the life of Muhammad did not occur in Saudi Arabia, but they occurred, oh surprise of surprises, in what is now modern-day Israel, close to the Dead Sea. And finally, the various cults of Islam, the Shiite, the Sunni, who are in a constant war with each other and blowing up and killing each other over some dispute of succession of the Prophet. The Wahhabi are the radical extremist Islamists who primarily come from Saudi Arabia. And then there is Sufi, the so-called mystical branch of Islam, which I personally consider to be totally spurious and of no significance. Now, as I've noted, my education so far regarding Islam has primarily come from Dr. Bill Warner. I find his work to be exceptionally lucid and sober and squarely balanced on the textual material of Islam, and squarely balanced on the facts. So I'd like to just summarize some of the mind-opening points that I have acquired through listening to Bill Warner on YouTube. First of all, he points out that the Quran is not the only sacred text of Islam. There are three sacred books, the Quran, the Hadith, which are meaning traditions, which are traditional sayings, commentaries, and interpretations associated with the Quran. And then there is the biography of Muhammad. I'm not talking about a biography written today by a modern scholar or written by anyone in the 19th century or early 20th century, but the traditional biography handed down from the earliest sources, which I presume it to be. And Bill Warner says that this biography is 800 pages long and is extremely detailed in anecdotes and in descriptions of the situations in Muhammad's life, whether they be fabrications or not. It is an extremely detailed biography. And Warner points out the fact that there is something extremely misleading about Islam. Several things, actually. But one thing is that you cannot really know what Islam is by talking to Muslims or looking at the way they behave. He takes the view that if you want to know what Islam really is, which may be only known to a tiny fraction of those who call themselves Muslims, then you have to look at what is actually said in these three texts. And he also points out that it is held in Islam that the loyal and faithful Muslim behaves in the same way that Muhammad behaved. So as Bill Warner puts it, the true Muslim behaves in the same way that Muhammad behaved. And Muhammad is regarded as the most perfect of all human beings. So to do what he did is to achieve a kind of perfection. He also points out that there are two different texts written at two different times merged into what today passes for the Quran. There are the passages that were written in Mecca at the beginning of Muhammad's mission, and then there are the passages written in Medina in the latter part of his life. And this fact accounts for the baffling character of the Quran. That is to say, that in some passages, it appears to advocate or to promote tolerance and the acceptance of other religions and other faiths in coexistence with Islam. So it is these passages of the earlier or Mecca Quran that are often cited in defense of Islam to show that it is benevolent and that it is a religion of peace. I'll get to that phrase in a moment. But in fact, the second and larger part of the material in the Quran is not of that nature at all, and it concerns jihad and what to do about the kafir. In fact, Bill Wagner shows by a statistical analysis of line by line and page by page of this material, he shows that the greater part of the Quran is not concerned with how Muslims should behave to be Muslims. It is concerned about how Muslims should behave toward the kafir and how the kafir or infidel should be treated. And anyone who reads the Quran will notice immediately that regarding the way that the kafir should be treated, there is nothing but a constant stream of threats against the kafir. Threats about what will be done to the kafir who does not convert to Islam, or even those who do. And that is a fact in the content of the material. He also points to the key issue of Islamic scholarship called abrogation. That is to say that clerics, imams, and Islamic scholars who define the party line consider that later texts and later passages override or overwrite earlier ones. So even though there are passages that appear to advocate peace and tolerance in the Quran, they being the earlier passages are overruled by later passages which express aggression and threats, including threats of murder against the kafirs. Also, in a key elucidation, Bill Warner discusses the Islamic concept of taqiyya, which means deception or cheating. And taqiyya is an accepted procedure in Islam whereby the Muslim may deceive the kafir for the purposes of overcoming the kafir, obviously. And there is not just permission to lie and to apply taqiyya, deception, but there is an obligation to lie in defense of the faith. You might note that that factor, the permission and the obligation to lie, that is clearly evident in Islam, is also evident in Talmudic Judaism. And the parallels between Islam and Judaism are so close and so intense that I, for my part, would have to conclude that they are simply two expressions of the same insanity. You know, it's well known that the motto of the Mossad, which is taken from the Talmudic scriptures, is, "By way of deception, we shall wage war." Well, among the hadith, there are long and short commentaries upon the principles and teachings of the Prophet, if you will. And Bill Warner points out that the shortest or briefest hadith commentary is only three words long. And what are those words? Quote, "War is deception," end quote. The deception of taqiyya explicitly includes, and I say explicitly because there are passages of the Quran and other works that say this out front, it explicitly includes the tactic of smiling and being kind and, let's say, genial or hospitable toward the kafir, while at the same time, in the depths of your heart, you hate the kafir. This is approved behavior. This is prescribed and approved behavior in Islam. Now, I'm not saying that all the Muslims walking around on this planet practice that behavior, but I would ask you this question. If you are in the presence of some Muslims, whether they be in Palestine, in Iran, in Afghanistan, or whether they be Muslim converts in the United States, well, how would you know if they are practicing this behavior or not? So when you find yourself in the presence of a Muslim, any Muslim, if you're going to be in your right mind, you have to ask this question as you observe the behavior of that individual. Are they practicing taqiyya and the obligation to deceive? The logic behind that is, well, war is deception or deception is war. As long as the Muslim in any social situation is the underdog, is the minority, then he or she practices taqiyya in order to survive. Because there's no point for a Muslim to come out and express an uppity and arrogant attitude, clearly showing that he or she wants to dominate the Kafirs, if there is no real opportunity to achieve subjugation of the Kafirs. So taqiyya is a strategy of deception that is used in Islam so that Muslims can infiltrate the non-Muslim society and appear to put on an acceptable face until such time, by one means or another, they are able to subjugate and dominate that society. Finally, in this summary, before I come around to the home stretch of this newsletter, I'd like to point out that Bill Warner says explicitly two things over and over again. One is that Islam is not a religion. It is a political ideology. Therefore, the name of his site is politicalislam.org. He also points out that there is a factor of deception in the word peace when it is used by Muslims. What peace means to you is not what peace means to them. Peace in the Islamic paradigm, if I might use that benign expression, means the condition of human society across the entire planet that comes to be achieved by the total submission of the kafir to Sharia law, that is, to theocracy, including all of its fine points, such as the medieval mindset of punishment, sequestration and sexual apartheid of women, marriage of child brides, forced marriage of child brides as young as 9 years old, who are then raped. Bill Warner points out that the biography of Muhammad openly describes how he raped his child bride, Aisha. And if you want to see a depiction of that, I've provided the link in the notes that go with this newsletter. Now, in coming around to the home stretch here, I will mention one final point, really an arresting and a shocking point that Bill Warner makes. He says that in the mindset of Islam and in the view of those Muslims who are actually loyal to what it is and not mere dupes who are swept along in the system, born into the system, and living under the risk of murder if they try to leave, but among those who are true to the system, they consider that you, a kafir, by not accepting that there is only one God, Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet, and by not converting to Islam, that you are offending them. It is an offense to be a kafir. So when you stand in front of a Muslim as a non-believer and a non-Muslim, that person is offended by your very existence. Now, I'm coming around to the end of this talk. It's a difficult talk. I think I'm getting through it pretty well. There are many digressions and different directions that I could go in, but I'm coming around to the central issue of offense. And in that respect, you might want to go back and listen to the NAV briefing called May the Righteous Be Damned. I've provided the link. In that briefing, I discuss the problem, the issue, the phenomenon, whatever you want to call it, of being offended. Now, I've been wanting to talk about Islam for some time. That's why I had scheduled it for the final talk of the 9 newsletters. But I jumped to 8, and I'm doing it earlier than I thought I would, in consequence of the events that took place last week in Paris. What happened was that some cartoonists, satirists, who are kafirs, offended Islam. Now, I like to say Islam. I'm learning to say that from Bill Warner. It doesn't say they offended Muslims. There's a problem with Muslims, that they are too stupid and too duped to know what their own belief system compels them to do. But some of them do know. And those are the ones that are always described as what? Oh, the extremists, the radicals, the very few. And yet those very few are the ones who are acting out the true meaning of Islam. And so, the texts say, and Muhammad himself demonstrated in his behavior, in his actions, that when a kafir offends Islam, offends the system, by portraying and or ridiculing the Prophet, then the correct way to behave, the correct thing to do at that moment, is to slay the kafir. Period. Or, maybe I should say, exclamation mark. So, if you step back for a moment and consider that proposition, you see that it's extremely alarming. What you encounter in Islam is an extreme irrational response of offense, of being offended, being insulted, and it's not even personal. This is an observation, I think, that needs to be made here. They are not insulted personally. Their belief system and the founder of their belief system is insulted, but they take that insult as if it were directed to them, and if they are loyal and observing of the imperatives of Islam, well, they act against that offense. This description is vivid, I would say, and it shows, it indicates, an extremely dangerous mindset. Now, it is a fact that some Muslims, some Islamists behave in this way, but not all of them. What I would like to do in concluding this talk is to consider, just from my point of view, to put out to you a proposal. I don't like to use the word suggestion, but something to think about regarding what's behind all this. What's behind this tendency to be offended and to react violently? Well, in the talk, May the Righteous Be Damned, which is NAV briefing number 105 of January 16th, last year, almost exactly a year ago, I proposed that being offended is just a pretext for being righteous or for showing your righteousness. So offense and righteousness are causally and psychologically intimately connected. Now, I would like to add a further observation to that point that I made in that NAV briefing, number 105. It's a simple observation. I like it for its simplicity and directness, and it goes like this. I introduce my observation with the word worthiness and with the variation of that word, self-worth. Well, self-worth, or self-esteem, if you will, is a fundamental factor in human character. And every single human animal, no matter what culture, no matter what faith or belief system, has some kind of sense of self-worth. Now, what would be the two extreme forms of self-worth that could be exhibited by human animals? And is there evidence that these forms do in fact exist? Well, one extreme form of self-worth or worthiness would be to consider yourself and your tribe or nation to be worth more than everyone else in the world. You would be, as it were, you would have a high, high estimation of your own worth and the worth of those with whom you identify in one way or another, either through your belief system or through your racial identity. And so the extreme self-worth would be, quite simply, identical or indistinguishable from an attitude of racial supremacy and an attitude of a kind of master race mindset. So are there any people on the planet who are known to have this mindset? Well, certainly, the so-called Jews. And there are very widely cited quotations coming from Jewish sources, namely some Jewish politicians of our time and some rabbis of the Lubavitch cult, to the effect that a Jewish life is not an ordinary life and it is worth more than a non-Jewish life. And they are quite explicit in coming out and making this statement of supremacy and extreme self-worth. That's one extreme. But what would be the opposite extreme to that? Well, it would be a total and absolute sense of worthlessness. Now, is there any evidence that there are people or a group of people, an identifiable community, if you will, of people on this planet who have a total sense of abjection and absolute worthlessness? Well, how would you know if there were such a group? Well, you would know by the statements they make about themselves, their premises of self-identification, as it were, and by the manner in which they behave. Well, those 1.4 billion members of the human race who adhere to Islam are in a state of submission. That is to say, they are in a state of abjection. They are abject. They are abject creatures who have submitted to a higher authority and an off-planet deity. Of course, it is the archons who are behind both Judaism and Islam. That should be obvious. So, you may now smile and recall the theme song for this newsletter, Stuck in the Middle. This is where you are If you're a genuine human being who sees the dire situation on this planet regarding those two Abrahamic religions, those two particular ones, putting Christianity aside for a moment, because it doesn't figure into this equation. As a matter of fact, Judaism is simply one extreme of a self-worth pathology, and Islam is the other extreme. And the final proof, I would say, or the convincing piece of proof regarding my proposition, is this. The tendency to be so offended that is demonstrated by Muslims is demonstrated by any human creature who is insecure and has a very low sense of self-worth. That's just common sense. That's an observation that you can make anywhere at any time. You will find that if you're in a social situation and there is a person who is easily offended or gets violently upset from being offended, you will find that that person does not necessarily have to be a Muslim, but what they would have in common with Muslims is a totally abject and debased sense of self-worth. And so, if you are trying to understand what it means to be a human being and avoid these two extremes, then you're stuck in the middle with me between clowns and jokers. And both the clowns and jokers, like the Joker in the Batman series, are criminally, pathologically insane, and they are very dangerous. So I would characterize the human condition as being stuck in the middle between these two extremes. And the question is, what to do about that? Well, I'm not going to prescribe anything here regarding tactics and strategies to defeat Islam. Were I to speak in that manner, I would do so in the frame of the Kalika War Party, and I do have some things to say there. But leaving that aside, drawing a boundary here, just let me conclude in this way. Position yourself or picture yourself stuck in the middle between a tiny, tiny, fractional part of the human race who holds a version of self-worth placing them even beyond humanity as to be more perfect, more divine than the non-Jews or the Gentiles or the Goyim. And on the other side of you, 1.6 billion human creatures who are walking around in a state of abject worthlessness. Now, let's say they're on the left and they're on the right. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right, whatever. Well, you've got to turn to the Jewish supremacists and deal with them in a certain fashion. Then you have to turn to the other side and deal with Muslims in a certain fashion. And the way that I propose to deal with Muslims is to draw a line in the sand. It's not the same, and it's not nearly as complicated and difficult to deal with them as it is to deal with you know who. With the Muslims, all you have to do is say, look, I'm a kafir, I'm an infidel, and if you're standing in front of me, then you are in my society, in my world, because I don't go to your world. I'm not going to Saudi Arabia or Pakistan or any Muslim country. So if I meet a Muslim, I meet them in the white Western humanistic society. And I have to say that there's a line right there in the sand, and Muslims can stay on that side of the line. And they need to be kept on that side of the line. That is to say, they need to be kept in their place where they do not impose any of their Islamic beliefs or imperatives upon the kafir. And inevitably, I can't elaborate on it because I'm at 1 hour and 6 minutes and I'm going to end at 1 hour and eight. Inevitably, this confrontation must take a particular form. And I'm going to plant in your minds the seed of the resolution to the confrontation with Islam. It has to do with a factor of threat. The Muslims in the Western world, for instance in Britain, have been known to go out on the street with placards and say, death to those who insult Islam, death to those who insult the Prophet, we're going to conquer the UK, we're going to do this. They have openly declared threats against white Western humanist society, or white Western Christian society, if you will. And the way that I now propose for you to consider to respond to Muslims threatening the kafirs is, guess what? For the kafirs to threaten Muslims. And so the line in the sand is a declaration of a threat. Because if you draw a line in the sand and there is no threat, then the party on the other side of that line can just walk across it. No problem. There would be no consequences. So, symbolically or metaphorically speaking, the way to keep Islam, which is a horrific system of theocratic tyranny, the way to keep it from invading and conquering a free society is to meet it with a threat. And what would that threat be? I'll leave you with that question. And I may pick up this topic in a second talk soon or in a newsflash, but I do intend to conclude the newsletters with some final observations on a more positive and elevating topic, that is romantic individuality.